F2. Number 25B.
Punsas, if right at this moment we would have that purity of being one with the Christ and have only the nature of God within us and only valuing the nature of God within us, we would never suffer for Christ. But Jesus showed that those born of the flesh, that they have within their body, as Paul would say, you know, all the sins of the flesh. We just can't step from one day to the other into heaven. There is a way, and Christ is the way. So we suffer only because we are not completely willing to be one with God. The moment we cleanse and cleanse ourselves in consciousness and cleanse ourselves, we just don't anymore have an attraction to anything that is not God-like, then we will no more suffer. Then the whole world can do what it wants to do. It doesn't touch us anymore. That is symbolized through Jesus' life to the point of crucifixion. Then after crucifixion, he has overcome the world. Then the world couldn't touch him anymore. So Peter explains this, and he shows how suffering for the Christ really is only a sign of grace of God. It's not the devil. If we suffer for Christ, for our conviction, if we stand for our conviction and we are persecuted, we are only persecuted because we take ourselves personal. Not because of the bad men over there that persecutes us. It's within us. It's all within us. We take it personal. If we could take it in person, we would never be persecuted. If we could take it inorganically, we would never be persecuted. So all that is persecuted is our false sense within us. And that has to go. That has to go out. So he shows really that behind that suffering for Christ is the grace of God. And he shows it in all sorts of ways. So again, when one comes to the Christ sense, it's always showing that there is an absolute sense about it, that we are perfect in the Son of God, and there is that standpoint from the human plane of living, which says, well, I have to claim that and make it my own. You see, from the absolute sense, he says that we are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation. Nothing can touch us. And we have obtained an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven. That's the promise. But he says, you must work that out. You must make that a living fact to you. And so from the human point of view, it seems as if we would really have a Christian pilgrimage, where we have to go through certain difficulties and sufferings. And so he says, the time of our journey here in fear. See, in spite that there is that absolute promise that we are, that the promise is kept in heaven, from the human point of view, it's a pilgrimage in fear, in trouble, in struggles, where we have to overcome everything within us which is not Christ-like. Calling us strangers and pilgrims, reminding really each Christian that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lusts of men, but to the will of God. So the Christ sense of the blood of Christ is very explicit in this epistle. It doesn't show the glory of Christ alone, but the blood of Christ. Now that's the blood of Christ, actually the symbol, showing the blood as a symbol of laying down the mortal. With the precious blood of Christ, as a lamb without blemish and without spot, are we cleansed. You See, we are cleansed through the precious blood of Christ. We will never really reach that day of rest without that we are willing, the blood of Christ, willing to lay down everything which is human within us. It's not enough to lay down the mortal alone, but also the human. That's where we don't like to go further. That's where we stop, usually. So, he shows that that Christian pilgrimage, that Christian way, the Christ way, is really a way through suffering to glory, not to hell. Our suffering doesn't end in hell. The suffering for the Christ. The sin against the Word, that ends in hell. It's punished everlastingly. But the suffering for Christ ends in the glory of God. So he always shows, right, that the sufferings of Christ and of the glory that should follow, the glory that should follow. That's why we should be careful that when we have the suffering for Christ, that we don't accept it as suffering, but as the glory that should follow. That we anticipate already the glory that will follow. Then the suffering isn't anymore so sting. Hasn't a sting anymore. He shows that Jesus, that Peter was a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. You will see in that epistle always that combination through suffering to glory, suffering to glory, suffering to glory. He never leaves it at suffering. He always anticipates the end of it, the purification of it. He speaks about the God of all grace who has called us unto his eternal glory by Jesus Christ. After that ye have suffered a while and makes you perfect. He in many ways shows that this suffering is transitionary. Not forever, transitionally. It's a suffering a while, or he says for a season. And it gives a glory of which he always says that is eternal. A glory, a crown of glory that fadeth not away. Can you see, you know how in the translation of mortal mind you have that transitionary period. Transitionary qualities. And so it shows that the Christ is that which expresses itself for a while, for a moment, as suffering, but it's only transitionary. Whereas the end of that process is the glory, and that glory is eternal. If we only could think of these things while we are in the boiling pot, at the end of it will be glory, and that's forever. So, quite logically, you see, he asked, therefore, to rejoice in suffering. Not to make a long face, see, but to rejoice in suffering for the Christ. But rejoice, he says, inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's suffering. And if ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye. I wasn't very happy when I was reproached for going this way. and all the persecution starts, you know. Until one began to see, well, one shouldn't be unhappy about it, but should be happy about it. And so, at one time, when the fires were rather hot, and one just felt that everything was going down, see, the church persecuted you, your friends left you, you lost everything for it, well, then I began to handle that. I began to handle it, and I just began to handle it and said, well, you're a silly old boy. What really happens is that the Christ has called you. to see something higher, something more scientific, something which will lead on the century. What are you to be troubled about it, make a long face about it, be despairing about it? And I began to handle it through all the synonymous terms by just seeing how mind has called us, and has called us, and therefore mind just loves us for knowing this truth and for following this truth. And that spirit just will bless us beyond measure with the fruits of spirit and with the substance of being and everything for following this idea. That soul is just loving to see how we identify what we see with our life. And therefore that soul will protect us against everything, that nothing will touch us, that nothing could touch my health, nothing could touch my substance, nothing could touch my life, that soul is so untouchable, and therefore my very willingness to follow the idea of the Christ would be a protection against anything, against animal magnetism, against malpractice, against every attack, against accident, against anything. And I never felt safer and happier and stronger at that time when I did it. So just know, rejoice when the day of Christ is coming. It says it's suffering, but it isn't true. It isn't suffering. It's the first sign that the glory of God is coming on us. So he says that suffering always ends when the Christ nature is fully manifest in us. So whenever that suffering for Christ seems to come, well, just turn to the one Christ and just fill and claim your thought of that Christ that is just coming to us and blessing us and blessing us, sustaining us, helping us, protecting us, loving us, caring for us in every way, in every shape and form. Then we don't consider it anymore as suffering. Yes, well, that's the tone, you see, of First Peter. He shows really that we can't go the way of the Christ without that something happens within, on the plane of the human and of the mortal. And that there is a purification going on within us. We call it suffering, but it isn't suffering. It is the Christ's glory knocking at the door and establishing itself in us. So let's go quickly through the seven subjects which he shows in the Christ order, because it's the impact of the Christ coming to us, not letting us rest until everything is put straight within us. So it's put in that Christ order. I don't want to go through the text, but just through the pinpoint, really, what proofs. You see, we are in the D. D is the living proof which we have to give that really our faith in the Christ is a living faith, that we don't sidestep the demands of the Christ. So what proof shall we give? In principle, he says, the proof you have to give in principle is that you really undergo the trial of our faith, that you are really willing to be corrected, and that you are really, really willing that everything which is in you and which is not yet completely principle-like, that you let that be corrected, that you have that meekness, you see, to undergo the purification of principles, to undergo the trial of faith. That is a proof that you really have faith in Christ, that you don't stem yourself inwardly against everything which the Christ wants to purify within ourselves. Then in life, he says, well, what proof can we give that we really have faith in the Christ? Well, the Christ comes as life and wants us to be reborn in the world, to lead us along the way of life. So the proof we give is that we really tread in the way of life, that we really follow the way of life, that we don't follow the way of the world, the way of what people would like us to do, the way which is accepted by the world, and so on. Conformity, conformism, and so on. That's not the proof that we go the way. The proof that we go the way is that we really accept the way of life. Then in truth, he shows that we give a proof that our faith in Christ is a living faith when we submit ourselves to the Christ ideal and let us be fashioned anew, so to say, according to the Christ ideal. You get at once again the sense, you see, that you have to take some cross on you. In every one of these subjects, you take the cross on you. Only the cross can wear the crown. See, you know how in Christ and Christmas, the last picture there is that you have a very dark crown, a very dark cross in the front, and a bit higher up, and already a bit more lighted, is a cross that blossoms, has birds on it, winged thoughts on it already, flowers on it. It's no more so dark and so heavy as the first cross, and it's in one line of life, and the projection of this dark cross is first a lighter cross, and the final projection is not a very white cross, a crown. It projects itself not as a cross, it projects itself as a crown. And that's what Peter teaches in this epistle, you see. He teaches that the would you say the projection, when it is that the right, you remember what it is, you see that in that light, that if we project it heavenward, that every cross becomes a crown and not a heavenly cross. There is no heavenly cross, so to say, you see, it's a crown. And he sees that, you see. So he asks us, you see, to lay down that heavy cross. And in truth it is what we have to lay down within ourselves, what we usually don't like, what the human in us doesn't like, is to lay down the human sense of manhood and to subject it completely to a Christ ideal, to a Christ manhood. Then in love, he shows that proof which we have to give in our life really is that we uphold the Christ love. That we uphold always the Christ love. See, that we don't uphold a separation between men and men. That we don't uphold a difference between I'm good, he's bad. I'm advanced, he's not advanced. I know it, he doesn't know it. See, all that separation. But where the Christ love in us is that love where we see the world as God sees it, where we see the universe as God sees it. Love, never losing the sight of loveliness. Always think of that sense when you read the epistles. It's the Christianity sense where love never loses sight of loveliness. Where it says love is never without its object and manifestation. Or manifestation. See, I never know one sentence right out of the textbook. But somehow I know the tone of it. That's really what we have to do in the Christianity sense. See, never to lose sight of loveliness. The moment we lose sight of loveliness, if we are without the object of lovely manifestation, well, we have our unity with God and mankind is disrupted, can you say, is put to part. Is put to part. There is a rupture. Yeah. And you can't make a verb out of it, out of rupture. Ruptured. Yeah. And a verb to rupture. No?
Yeah?
Oh. Fine. Now, soul. Soul. He says, well, what proof shall we give, really, that we believe that God is soul? And in our Christ sense of soul. And he says, well, we give the proof then when we rejoice while we suffer. That we really can anticipate, you see, the promised joy while we suffer. If we suffer and say, well, that's now so, and the Christ wants us to suffer, and that's why it's, the Christ comes, and therefore that brings suffering, well, therefore, let me suffer it through, then we don't give a proof of soul. We don't give a proof of soul. The proof of soul is that we rejoice, because soul reflects itself in joy and in rejoicing, not in suffering. So the proof we give is that we rejoice in the promise while we are suffering. There are quite a few wonderful references there. Then in spirit, see, we are cleansed further and further, and so he says, what are the proof, really, that we have a Christ love, that we have a Christ spirit? He says, only as we shepherd God's heritage in the Christ spirit can we receive the crown of glory. He speaks here a lot about this tending, the flock of God. See, the devotion of God. That's the affection for everything. It says only if we have that shepherding sense, that affectionate sense, spirit which worship, which is that adorable one, which ponders everything in its loveliness, that is what the proof which we have to give. Then in mind, he says something very necessary. He says, well, the proof which we have to give is that we really handle animal magnetism. That's the proof which we have to give. That we don't let animal magnetism alone. That Christ proof we have to give. The Christ mind is that which can handle animal magnetism. Because animal magnetism is a false belief that mortal mind has a Christ. That mortal mind can operate as also, that mortal mind also has a modus operandi. And so we better watch and handle animal magnetism. So again, you see, we see another sign of proof that we really love the Christ mind if we handle the counterfeit of the Christ mind, namely animal magnetism, and handle it consistently and coherently. Well, that's First Peter. Is that clear? See how what he wants to show. And so let's take the second epistle of Peter, which gives us the complementary aspect of this Christ faith. See, I said it illustrates those two translations in the textbook, depicting in the first epistle of Peter that the Christ always comes to us and brings a stir within us that does not let any evil remain in us, stay with us. But it ultimates in glory. It ultimates in understanding, in a divine spiritual understanding. That's why the third degree in the second translation of mortal mind is called understanding. And the qualities there, which we find there under that third degree, like wisdom, purity, spiritual understanding, spiritual power, love, health, holiness, are seven ideas of the synonymous term. A full range of understanding. That's the end of that translation. So, the second epistle to Peter has its accent now on that understanding. No more on the suffering. It shows that that suffering works and works on us for the one and only purpose that we arise in understanding. Because only as we arise in understanding, naturally, we let go of misunderstanding, and misunderstanding is the cause of all suffering. If we don't misunderstand God, nothing can touch us. Nothing can touch us. So, his strong point here in Second Epistle is about that Christ understanding. And this is really a very, very, very important point, what he makes here. He doesn't just talk about that we should have understanding. He says he has to deal with a situation which arose at his time and which, under another name and in other forms, arise today. Namely, at his time, he had to deal in the churches with all sorts of isms. Among them was one which was very widespread, and that was Gnosticism. And not only Gnosticism, he had also to deal in the Christian churches with a philosophy which was called antinomianism. You call it like that, Margie, or you say antinomianism? Well, it doesn't matter how it is called. It's a Greek word, you see, and means the following. First, gnosis. Gnosis is a Greek word which, and was a Greek philosophy, which said that all what is needed is a higher knowledge, and if we have a higher knowledge, a higher intelligence, a higher enlightenment, that is completely enough for salvation. See, it's like perhaps today material science, which says all what we need is that we know everything about matter, everything about chemistry, everything about the electrons and so on, and then we can establish the kingdom of heaven on earth. It's a newer form of Gnosticism. Or you have it in the Christian scientists who say, I have gone through class and I have read a lot and now I know it. And now I build on that knowledge which I have known, which I have gathered together. That's a new form of Gnosticism. Don't look at me. I'm going to show you what it means. Something much nicer, much more wonderful than just have that sense of Gnosticism which says, now I have read all the books, now I have read all the unpublished writings of Mrs. Eddy, I've gone through class, now I know what I know. Now, with that knowledge, I'm going to practice all my life. That's Gnosticism in the newer sense. A higher knowledge, and thinking that will bring salvation, and it will not. And you know that it does not, or the Christian Zionist movement wouldn't go down as it does. And that he encountered already at that early stage. Now the other term, antinomianism, is a Greek word which is combined of two words, of anti and nomos, meaning anti is against, in opposition to, and nomos meant the law.